Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Night Stalker by Jeff Rice. Monday, April 27th, 1970. Tony Vincenzo is a small, dried-out, Brooklyn-born Sicilian of such commanding presence and warmth that for years he had been totally disregarded by the Cosa Nostra, the Knights of Columbus, and the Italian-American Club. Vincenzo of the rapier wit. Where else would you put a discard but in a trash can? Vincenzo didn't think it was worth speculation, even though a cop cover-up was as plain as flies in a pail of milk. By the end of the fourth day, after getting my fill of cold stares from Chief Butcher, Sheriff Reese Lane, and the DA himself, I knew something was up. Fortunately, I still had friends among the undertaking trade who would, for a generous stipend, look the other way while I performed some mild necrophiliac investigations. I first saw what was left of Cheryl Ann Hughes late Wednesday afternoon, April 29th, in the cold room of the Willows, one of our town's leading undertaking establishments. At first, I, too, in my untrained way, saw nothing remarkable about the reasonably attractive young woman who had been neatly opened by the coroner's scalpel and then just as neatly stitched closed. It is usually best when examining four-day-old corpses to take as impersonal an attitude as possible, so I didn't really look at her face until I was through inspecting the body and was replacing the sheet. Then I saw the two little holes. At first, I couldn't figure out what they might be, largely because I didn't try. They didn't register at all until I was sliding her back into her icy little nook. Then some little ghost of a thought flitted through my mind, and without thinking, I pulled her back out and took a second look. I called in my well-bribed contact man and asked him what the holes were. "Funny, I never noticed those," he said. "Bullshit. He's a professional, and he'd notice something like that right away." From his deliberately obtuse manner and his sudden myopia, I gathered I was really onto something. But what? A girl who died under mysterious circumstances? A murder? No clues, no motive. But not just written off? Oh no. Written off and swept under the rug by the very people who should have been running around in a sweat trying to solve the crime. With my usual tact, I managed to receive a first warning from Vincenzo before the week was out. Quit bugging the PD. When something breaks, they'll let us know. Meanwhile, use your head and lay off. Whatever they're up to, they don't want any help from amateur bloodhounds like you. And neither does the boss. Marvelous. Vincenzo never ceases to amaze me. I've never figured out why he became a newsman, and I use that term loosely. He's been one since 46 and has never had the ambition or curiosity to look outside to see if it was raining. We have locked horns so many times, I've lost count. And it's sad because he is basically a decent, honest, hard-working man. But he plods. He toes the mark. He never crosses the line or the publisher, even if it means a scoop. I suppose some of this is unfair because, all in all, he has been a friend at times. Okay, I'm unfair. But I can still smell out a story. Vincenzo's sinuses are perpetually blocked. He has all the new sense of a tree stump. Added up. Dead girl in a garbage can. Two puncture marks on her neck. No known enemies. Money in her purse. Not sexually assaulted. No established motive. No clues. The night before the second victim, Bonnie Reynolds, was discovered, I sniffed out the startling information from a county general intern that the Hughes girl didn't bleed at all during the autopsy. All corpses bleed. I was just formulating my crazy theory when Mrs. Reynolds was found and was alert for new developments on the Hughes thing when the call came in over the police radio. Monday, May 4th, 1970. I got there probably less than 15 minutes after the first squad car. I got a good look. If anything like the sight of Bonnie Reynolds' crumpled form could be called a good look. Of course, having to write it up before the autopsy, I was in no position to know that she, too, was found drained of every drop of blood. Nor could I, with any grain of common sense, openly speculate on that, especially since I hadn't been given any clearance to report the speculations and rumors about the first death. Vincenzo made one mistake. He let me print the fact that there were two puncture marks in her neck, even though he wouldn't let me link the fact with the similar marks on Miss Hughes. The public wasn't treated to that little bit of information until Carol Hanocek was found, clad in a see-through shorty nightgown and panties, the following Monday morning around 9, the kitchen floor of her ground-level apartment on either street behind the Bird of Paradise Hotel. Monday, May 11th, 1970. Carol Hanocek was crumpled up in a corner between the stove and the kitchen wall. Her roommate, Sandy Jensen, a brokerage house receptionist between jobs, had gotten up, wandered into the kitchen, and discovered Carol, whom she thought had fainted or fallen. She spent a few anxious minutes trying to revive her, not noticing the neat puncture marks under her right jaw. Finally, she summoned an ambulance, and the crew, knowing a dead one on sight, made no further attempt to find the cause, but notified the sheriff's office. Carol, a swing shift cocktail waitress in the Bird of Paradise show lounge, had gotten home, guesswork here, around 2:15, 2:30, poured herself a glass of milk, and had opened the back door of the kitchen for reasons unknown. Fingerprints were later found on the outside knob that, while smudged, didn't belong to either girl. She had opened the door and died. Suddenly, quietly, without disturbing her sleeping roommate only a few feet away. Like Cheryl Ann Hughes, Carol was a blonde, 23 and just a bit over 5'5", though somewhat chunkier, weighing in at 130 or thereabouts. Like Cheryl Ann, she lived within walking distance of her job and had no car. Unlike either of the first two victims, Carol Hanocek had never been married and had never, Regent House examination later revealed, born children. She was described by co-workers and the lounge's bar manager to be gregarious, efficient, and straight, with no steady boyfriends and no record of any trouble either at work or, to their knowledge, in a private life. Something of a pattern had started to form, and it was ugly. Young girls, all engaged in casino-oriented jobs and all working after dark, were dead. All were seen more or less frequently with men, none of whom were then or later very good suspects. I was certain it was the work of one individual and assumed him to be a male, well over 200 pounds. He would need size and strength to accomplish his gruesome task quickly and silently, and definitely of doubtful emotional stability. I also decided he was a white man. I'll explain that in a minute. I further decided the individual involved got some kind of twisted sexual thrill from the killings and the way they were performed. None of the three women died from heart failure, burst blood vessels, crushed larynxes, or broken necks. There were few bruises except just under the throat in both the first and third cases, indicating little of any struggle. Discount the badly bruised body of Bonnie Reynolds in this context because the bruises did not kill her, though it was revealed in her autopsy her right arm was dislocated, most likely in the fight. No, they all died, Regan House said later, from shock induced by massive loss of blood. How the blood was lost was where my theory differed from the professional investigators, and why I must now digress once more to tell something of myself and my background. It will be dull, but brief. My given name is Carol, but no one has ever managed to spell it correctly, hence the use of Carl. The course of my work I've been called worse names. I'm 47, a second-generation American, old enough to get blooded in Europe by almost 2 years of combat, most of it behind a typewriter, and lucky enough to have a trick knee left over from that war to miss out on that little police action in Korea. I managed to graduate from Columbia University with a BA in journalism in 1948 without any distinction, unless being near the bottom of my class qualifies in that respect. My grandparents were immigrants. Pop grew up a hesitant, agnostic, and superstitious, Mom was a believer in people. My grandmother was a shadowy figure in my life as she died of heart failure 2 years after Pop was born. I was closest to my grandpop, Anton, a cabinet maker from Romania with a penchant for telling his young grandson endless folktales in the dark of night, but always with a grain of salt included, or a few historical facts as footnotes, such as his disclosure to me that there really was a Count Dracula, a 15th century warlord known as the Impaler, because he used to pin his enemies to the ground with stakes for entertainment. It was said he often drank the blood of his victims at dinner, his cup a human skull. These were the fairy tales of my childhood. They led me to the movie house on Saturdays and kept me up half the night afterwards. Then I grew up and forgot all about my fairy tales when Adolf Hitler proved to the world that wholesale horror could never be safely tucked away between the covers of a work of fiction. Out of this kind of background, plus a slight knowledge of abnormal psychology acquired along the way from college to newspapering, I developed my initial theory, to wit, we had a nut running around who had taken all that blood-sucking stuff in movies too seriously. At least, I thought then, he had taken it enough to heart to use some kind of an instrument to puncture the carotid arteries of three women while somehow keeping them absolutely still and quiet. Somehow this character had managed to draw off 10 to 12 pints of blood from each victim, and after due consideration, I surmised that in his twisted logic, he drank the blood. This, as you will discover later, is not such a fantastic idea as you might think, and he was very neat. Not a trace of blood was ever found except on Bonnie, around her abrasions. He had to be big. That was obvious, and as I contended earlier, white. But a white man moving quietly about in the night might well not be considered suspicious in a viewer's mind. After all, Vegas is a 24-hour town, and nearly a fourth of its workforce is up at what most people consider ungodly hours. It is not at all unusual to see pale, distinguished-looking men in tuxedos carrying around lumpy sacks that turn out to contain laundry. At 3 a.m., they are captains and maitre d's and baccarat dealers and musicians getting off late shifts. Women in bikinis and thongs doing their weekly marketing just before sunrise are common sights in Vegas. No. And he was probably well-dressed, possibly with a late-model car. A very middle-class type of character, not a sneaking second-story type with turtleneck sweater, mask, and tennis shoes. Having spoken of my theory to Vincenzo, and having met with his usual stone wall of resistance, I kicked it up on to the managing editor, Llewellyn Cairncross, who looked at me out of his one good eye and said with his customary tact, "Bullshit. Kolchak, for years I've suspected you were mentally deranged, and now have confirmation of that suspicion. Why don't you go to Alaska, or Florida, or anywhere, and plague somebody else for a change?" So, very patiently, while jamming his office door shut so he couldn't throw me out, I went over everything I had come up with, including the tight-lipped comments from the police department and the sheriff's office. "Okay, Lou, what conclusion do you come to?" He started to fire off one of his legendary put-downs, but it died before it ever rolled off his tongue. He slammed his mouth shut and glared at me with that bloodshot eye. Then he called the boss, Jacob E. Jake Herman, editor and publisher, Herman the Heinous, Herman the Magnificent, part crusader, part charlatan, once the scourge of crooked politicians, now a political kingmaker. Before Howard Hughes came to our fair city, he was one of the state's biggest wheeler dealers, and I suspect he would still teach the bashful billionaire a few tricks, and probably will. I went to sit with Jake's assistant, Bess Melvin, a truly lovely person who could smell a used item through 2 feet of reinforced concrete. The 15 years she devoted to Jake Herman showed in the frustration and tiny crow's feet on her thin, attractive face. I always thought it too bad that she didn't own and run the Daily News. Too bad for the public, and as it turned out later, too bad for me. The phone rang. Bess picked it up and handed it to me. The receiver growled with electronic venom. "Kolchak, you miserable son of a bitch. If you ever, ever go over to Vincenzo's head again..." I let him sputter on. When he paused for breath, I got him my 2 cents worth, and he surprised me by telling me to write the goddamn piece any way I saw fit. He told me to have Lou come into his office. I motioned toward a distinguished managing editor, and he entered his sanctum sanctorum. I returned to my typewriter, explained to the public all the things I have just explained to you, put the words in United Press's best recommended style, and headed for home, in the sure and certain belief that on May 12th I would either be well on my way to a Nevada Straight Press Association award for the best crime story of the year, or out of town on a rail. My story ran the next day with all my pet theories deleted. So much for Jake's much-vaunted word. It was not a propitious start at all. Later that day, the district attorney called to inquire whether I might not be better used by the Daily News in preparing an in-depth study of the treatment of the mentally ill, from personal experience, up in Sparks, Nevada, the bedlam of the Golden West. Tuesday, May 12th, 1970. I sulked in my apartment off Karen Court until I got a tip from an informant that Parkway Hospital had just been knocked over. Fine, I said. Knocked over for what? Cash? Drugs? Equipment? Blood, said my informant. Blood? Blood. Every damn container in the place. Clean sweep. They've had the sheriff's people out here all morning and have sent to the blood bank and to County General for some fill-in stock until they get stores flown up from California. I hung up and just sat there, looking out of my living room window at the gaudy concrete, candy-striped tent of the circus a half mile away on the strip. Man, I thought, you couldn't be this right. There really is a guy running around who thinks he's a... I couldn't bring myself to finish the thought. Parkway is less than a mile from my apartment, or where it was when I lived there. I keep slipping, can't help it. So I threw on some clothes and hied on over to talk with the chief resident, Dr. Stoddard Wells. He confirmed what I'd been told on the phone. Everything cold checked. Seems blood type and Rh factor didn't matter. Every ounce we had. Why? I can't imagine. Stuff won't keep without refrigerator, and even then, not forever. And there's no black market for the stuff that I know of. So why? Who knows? Dr. Wells' question was largely rhetorical, and it was clear he wanted to be off on his rounds. I headed back to my place and my upstairs den. Unlike many of my trade, I am not, or should say, was not, a clannish sort. Never a joiner, was neither a member of the Las Vegas Press Club, nor regular of any of the state bars and lounges, though I soon changed my ways, as you can see. When something takes hold of me, I don't know. And if I can't think where to go with it, the something, then I prefer to hole up in familiar surrounding and brood on it. That could be called laziness by some, and they'd be right. I am physically lazy. I'm about 5'10", weigh about 185 pounds, going on 200. I'm going bald and look a great deal like a boozy ex-prize fighter. My idea of exercise, lifting weights, for example, is to lift 185 pounds just once a day when I hoist myself out of bed. I like to do my legwork on the phone as much as possible, at least in the preliminary stages of gathering data on a beat. But I surprise even myself when I've got my teeth into something solid, because then I can go without sleep for 3 days and not even notice the meals I've missed. I lay on my L-shaped couch for the better part of 2 hours while the sun moved past its zenith and began to dip towards the Charleston Mountain area. Then, as the sun eased below the top of edge of my west-facing window and threw a little gleam in my eye, the idea came to me that FBI Special Agent Bernie Fain might be in a good enough humor to listen to me. So I slapped my half-empty Coors can on the coffee table and gave him a ring. He was in and, for once, not busy. So I invited him up, and 30 minutes later, over beer and pretzels, I went over what I had with him. His interest was rewarding. "You're nuts," he opined. I pressed on. "We have 3 murders. We have a guy, at least one, maybe more, who goes around grabbing young girls, so far all casino employees, and draining them of their blood. You're not supposed to know about that, much less talk about it." "Well, I do. What about your people, Bernie? This is nothing for the Bureau to mess with at this stage." "True. But you could make some unofficial inquiries for me." "Like?" "Like, to other police departments in the cities where we get our greatest flow of tourist traffic. L.A., Frisco, Denver, Chicago, St. Louis, Dallas, Miami, Boston, and New York. Like, check the hospitals in those cities, particularly the mental hospitals. Find out if there have been any other corpses like the ones found here. You know, bloodless and all that, and not necessarily women. Also, find out if there are any guys in these bug houses who think they're Count Dracula, even if they haven't done anything to prove it. Bernie just looked at me. You believe in vampires, little boy? Very funny, I said. Will you do it, or are you just going to sit there like a cheap gunnif and drink my beer? I'll think about it. Repeat, think about it. He glared at me. Everybody had taken to glaring at me. Vampires, Jesus H. Christ. I just sat there staring at the painting over my desk, a Transylvanian village street at night, with the wind blowing sheets of rain into the face of a bluish gabled building at a dirt road intersection. I had that painting for years. It brought back the tales of my grandfather's homeland and was smuggled into this country with him when he was a lad. After this thing was all over and I had left Vegas, looking at it made me uneasy. I have since burned it. I regarded Bernie with a sideways glance as he gnawed on a pretzel. You know about the blood stolen from Parkway Hospital? I asked him.
How much?
And the three dead girls? How much blood do you figure the average adult type girl has in her body?
About 10, maybe 12 pints.
So, I jumped in. If we add up what I've given you, in the past 16 days someone, or something, has taken 30 to 36 pints of blood from three women. And somehow, just by coincidence, of course, 30 pints of blood were stolen last night from Parkway. Don't you see any possible link?
Couldn't say. Maybe yes. Maybe no.
Bernie Fane, a fund of information, a wealth of suppositions, brother. Stop drinking my beer and listen to me. Add up the 30 or so pints of blood missing from the three corpses and the 30 pints from the hospital, and what do you get?
I get 30 to 36 pints missing from three women's bodies. Also, I get 30 pints missing from Parkway Hospital. I do not see an implicit connection between these things, and I sure don't see any vampires written into any of this.
Okay, fine, I told him. Close your eyes, and it'll go away. I'm only wondering on theory anyhow, but check out what you can for me, please. I want to be on top of this thing when the next one...
What next one?
How come you're so sure there'll be a next one?
That is part of the old Kolchak vampire theory. Whoever this character is, he has a lust for blood so powerful that fear of discovery won't hold him in check for too long. He's bound to strike again.
Sure, I know this is crazy. So was the situation where that kid shot 36 people from a campus tower at that Texas university? But I'm sure there's a connection between the disappearance of the hospital's blood and these murders.
Bernie gave me one of his sidelong glances.
Hope it won't disillusion you to know that the local law enforcement people share your views, somewhat, and are working along those very lines. If you'd stay in your office more, you might hear things on the radio. You're getting too fat and too lazy. Lay off my gut and proceed with your point.
Well, Kolchak, you're not the only one who likes to play detective. The police and sheriff's boy think they're pretty good at it, too. They think there's a possible connection between the missing blood and the dead women. Not that they buy that vampire crap.
Even in the face of no other easy explanation, I broke in.
But even so, he continued, they continued to probe and ask questions. Last I heard, they were waiting for a special report from two pathology experts who were flown up from the Los Angeles Police Department together with a small truckload of equipment. If you want to join me at the sheriff's office, they'll be meeting at 6:30 with Chief Butcher and the DA to present their findings. You may still be able to get into these little sessions if you haven't worn out your welcome with this stupid vampire theory of yours.
Well, thanks, Al. One other thing, Sherlock. Scuttlebutt is one of the Parkway nurses saw something.
Told the cops she'd noticed an orderly near the blood storage area last night. Her name's Amanda Staley. She only noticed him because he was new.
And?
And hospital records show no new orderlies hired in the past 3 months.
Got a description?
Mm-hmm. About 6'4" and skinny, pale, dark hair, and bad breath.
Whoopee. Bad breath. That ought to be a great help in finding him.
If you were a professional detective, maybe you could make some sense out of it. Since you're a writer and not a detective, it might be wise for you to stick to reporting and leave the detecting to us poor benighted professionals.
To know what I know, all you had to do was ask.
See you at 6:30.
He left me feeling like a punctured balloon.
The Beefsteak Room by Peter Haining. The old man leaned heavily on his walking stick as he turned out of the Strand and into Wellington Street. Before him loomed the accolonnaded front of the Lyceum Theatre, which was at once so intriguing and yet so mysterious to him. He had been in London before, of course, but then he'd had urgent business to attend to and no time for frivolous pursuits like going to the theatre. Now it was different, and he at last had the time to satisfy one of his longest-standing curiosities. For a moment, the bent figure stopped, pushed back the brim of his felt hat, and adjusted his glasses. His rheumy eyes moved slowly up the features of the building, a thin smile crossing his deeply lined face. In his mind, the old memories began to stir once again. He moved on slowly, scarcely aware of the people hurrying by intent on their afternoon business, and turned into the theater's vaulted foyer. A solitary figure was just visible behind the box office grill. The old man spoke in a voice that was little more than a whisper.
"Excuse. I wonder, might I have a ticket for this evening's performance, please?"
His English was still as halting as it had always been.
"Stalls or circle?" The reply from behind the grill was flat, disinterested.
"Oh, the circle, I think. What time am I coming for the performance?"
8:00. A single yellow ticket appeared beneath the grill. The old man slowly took out his wallet and paid without another word. If the ticket seller had been more communicative, he might have asked his opinion about the production. But then that was the least important element of his visit to the theater. He was getting very old now, and travel was becoming increasingly difficult. Dr. Abraham Van Helsing had come for just one last look at London, and especially at the place where Bram Stoker had first heard about vampires. The huddled figure in the circle seat might have been asleep for all the notice he seemed to take of the performance. In truth, Van Helsing's thoughts were far away, searching with his mind's eye beyond the walls of the auditorium, hoping that his researches into where the Beefsteak Room might be would prove correct. That famous room where the great Sir Henry Irving had often entertained his guests at dinner after having a performance at what was so eloquently known as the Sublime Society of Beefsteaks. Van Helsing, however, had learned the value of patience many years ago, and was content to remain in his seat until the performance was over. He was not even tempted to leave it during the interval. Then he politely joined in the applause with the rest of the audience and rose to make his way to the stairs at the rear. As he was about to leave the auditorium, his pace quickened for the first time that day, and his eyes grew brighter with expectancy. Outside, in the passageway, with its ornate decor and framed posters, Van Helsing saw a door marked "Staff Only." If his calculations were correct, a corridor lay beyond that door, which would lead him directly to the room he was seeking, the room where, on a certain night in April 1890, a Romanian expert on folklore, Arminius Vanbury, from the University of Budapest, had regaled Irving and Bram Stoker, then the actor's manager, with stories of the undead in his native Transylvania. Deliberately holding back until the last member of the audience had disappeared, Van Helsing placed his hand on the handle of the door and turned. It was unlocked. He stepped quickly inside and silently closed the door behind him. For a moment he remained without moving to make sure no one had seen or heard him, and also to let his eyes grow more accustomed to the darkness. Then he took a small flashlight from the pocket of his coat and switched it on. The beam of light revealed a corridor just as Van Helsing had expected. He stepped forward purposefully. Around the corner, the torch picked out another door. It was grimy and showed all the signs of not having been opened for years. Van Helsing lifted the arm of his coat and with his sleeve brushed away a layer of dust. There, still unmistakable but very faded, were the words, "Beefsteak Room, Private." The old man allowed himself a little sigh of pleasure. The handle of this door also gave way under his touch, the hinges screeching from lack of use as they slowly swung open. Inside, the darkness was almost tangible. Van Helsing's light cut into a room that had obviously once been richly ornamented and hung with costly furnishings. Even the few remaining tables and chairs, which were smothered in dust and hung with cobwebs, bore the hallmarks of quality. A smile lit up the intruder's face. His mind was now working quickly as he started to conjure up what the room must have looked like when it was full of lights and music, people in conversation, and tables groaning with fine food and wine. He had not moved more than a few steps into the room when a noise in the darkness interrupted his thoughts. It sounded almost like another door being opened, but not quite. More like a lid being raised, he thought, puzzled at why he should think so. Van Helsing's eyes narrowed in the gloom, and although he felt his pulse begin to race, he was not afraid. He had already braved so much during his long and active life. Suddenly he was aware of a figure in the shadows, the figure of a large, bulky man with a beard, a man dressed in immaculate evening suit. Van Helsing was hardly conscious of the figure moving, but almost at once the man had glided in front of him. "Welcome to the Beefsteak Room, Dr. Van Helsing." The voice seemed to be dredged up from deep inside the man, as if the vocal cords had not been in use for years. There was just a hint of a brogue in the accent, too. "I have been waiting a long time for you." Now fear suddenly replaced the quickening pulse in Van Helsing's body. He stumbled backwards and involuntarily raised the hands which clasped the torch. In its beam he now saw that the beard was red, while in the man's huge hands he was carrying a wooden stake and an iron hammer, the tools of his own profession. They were the last things the old vampire hunter ever saw, as the ancient voice spoke again. "My name is Bram," it growled. "Bram Stoker."